G'day. Before we get into today's episode, we just wanted to let people know that because today's episode is about trauma reactions, it may be challenging to some listeners, but we hope it'll be helpful for people's understanding of the psychological treatments of trauma. G'day, I'm Rowan Mackey, and I'm joined by my dad, clinical psychologist Chris Mackey, and this is Psych Spiels and Silver Linings. G'day, Dad. How are things?
Good, thanks, Rowan. Good to be with you today on a very important clinical and therapy topic.
Absolutely. We're all set here for our... We've got pages and pages of notes in front of us, and we're going to be doing another little two-part podcast on initially the topic of exposure therapy and then EMDR. So we've called today's episode Addressing Trauma Memories with Exposure Therapy. So, Dad's a little bit more of a clinical name in some ways, but it's also a little bit more of a clinical topic. Instead of asking what we're going to be talking about today, I think it'd even be worth asking maybe who this podcast is going to be particularly beneficial for before we get too far into it.
Okay, now, when people are referred to psychology practices, often there'll be problems with anxiety and depression, but another very common presentation is post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. It'll be probably one of the five or six main reasons why people would get referred to our practice. And post-traumatic stress disorder is certainly a key area of specialty that I've engaged in since 1990. So working with war veterans at the Heidelberg Repatriation Hospital in the early 90s, I've worked with many people who've been harshly affected by sexual abuse, and I've worked with many people who've been crime victims, for example, dealt with physical assault, many people who've also been affected by car accidents or other industrial accidents, say through the work cover system. And then people may have been diagnosed with a potentially fatal illness, or they've witnessed a horrific accident or a fatality. There's a whole range of ways that people might experience post-traumatic stress. And so a number of people also will be affected by this, where it doesn't quite reach a level of post-traumatic stress disorder, but it's very disruptive to their lives for a period of time. And so it actually helps to have some handle on ways of helping address trauma memories, because the key thing is when people are exposed to, say, a life-threatening event or a very traumatic or a horrific kind of experience, then often they'll have these lasting trauma memories of that particular situation. For many people, these memories will resolve somewhat spontaneously over a period of time. It might be weeks or months, and there's quite some recovery that people typically make, even over a couple of years, becoming more gradual recovery. However, if these difficulties are lingering, it's really affecting people's everyday functioning, then it's basically something which is worth addressing in a therapy setting. So hence one of the more common referrals to a psychology practice.
And we were just having a little bit of a look before it at the clients who come into our practice. And I believe it's roughly about 10% of people who seek therapy at our practice have PTSD. And so obviously there's going to be a lot of people out there today who maybe relate to what we're talking about and some of the therapies that we'll be talking about over the next couple of episodes. But we also thought maybe people's families as well. And maybe if you know someone or have a loved one who is going through, whether it be exposure or EMDR, we thought maybe this would help to demystify some of that process too, and maybe let you in a little bit on what they'll be going through and maybe why there might be a couple of things that maybe come up over those period of weeks where they're going through these therapies as well.
Yes, so in terms of a lifetime experience or lifetime prevalence, approximately 5% of men and maybe about 10% of women are likely to experience PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, at least at some point in their lifetime. So that's very many people who can be affected by that. Also, natural disasters would be another example. Bushfires, for example, can lead people to develop this condition that we'll talk about a little bit more later, what that involves. But one of the most important things with post-traumatic stress is, well, from a therapy situation, we would call it psychoeducation. And that means understanding these kind of reactions, helping make sense why people have these recurring intrusive thoughts, why people might have feelings of numbing, or how they're trying to block it out of their mind and recognizing how that might impact on them, recognizing how people might have anxiety or hyperarousal symptoms that go with these trauma memories. And sometimes people are concerned that they're losing their mind. They feel very different from usual. The world might seem a bit strange to them. They might feel a little bit detached. People might even have a complication of what we call dissociative symptoms that may occur in the context of PTSD. So psychoeducation is very important, and that also includes understanding what kind of therapy techniques exist to help address it. And a core therapy approach is what we're talking about today, exposure therapy techniques or exposure-based therapy. In the next podcast, we'll talk about EMDR, which stands for eye movement, desensitization and reprocessing, a particular kind of therapy which is very, very effective for many people, very efficient, very effective for dealing with trauma memories. But these therapies also have a challenging aspect to them, and we're partly talking about that today so people understand them further.
Well, I'm very excited to go through these couple of episodes. Yeah, you mentioned EMDR there. I reckon it's the closest thing to magic that I've come across. And so we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves talking about the next podcast, Dad. Let's get into exposure therapy, which we'll be talking about today. Because as you mentioned, exposure is a core principle of treatment for PTSD and trauma. And we'll be talking about this a little bit more, obviously, as the podcast goes on. But I suppose just to give a bit of a brief introduction, it seems that exposure therapy is basically about, well, pardon the pun, but exposing us to traumatic memories that we've gone through in the past and we may otherwise look to block out. So is that a bit of a fair overview?
Yes, it certainly is. It's exposing ourselves to trauma memories, which are largely feared memories. There's fear attached to the memories because there's a difference between a kind of trauma memory and an everyday memory, like, say, walking to the shop or what we did on holiday. And this was recognized by Freud many years ago. He recognized that there were different memory circuits in the brain. There are different ways that we could respond to memory. And just imagine if someone was very much at risk of losing their life. It might have been in a car accident. Well, in a sense, if we think through evolution, we're meant to remember the kind of things that could lead to a loss of life. Like think of, I suppose, prehistoric people. If they encountered a lion that looked to attack them, well, you'd want to remember that from just a single experience. The first time you ever encountered a lion, you'd forever want to remember that lions are dangerous. That would actually help the survival of the species, not just your own survival, but basically having some massive impact from a life-threatening situation would warn people, hey, don't go there again, or watch out for that kind of situation. So there's something about trauma memories that can seem somewhat more indelible. So in other words, they keep on repeating in someone's mind. They can be quite intense. They come with a high level of distress or arousal or anxiety. And because they're painful, people might look to block them out in certain ways. But the main thing is they stick more. And these are memories that also they can be, even in the back of your mind, they might be triggered in some way. So for example, if someone was in a situation where there was a shooting and they felt that they narrowly escaped, well, they could hear a car backfiring and that could trigger the memory because it's got this reminder, this similar aspect to their memory that could be triggered. So that's another thing about trauma memories. They can be evoked or triggered unpredictably, and we'll talk about some examples of that later on. Now, the thing is that's really tricky with trauma memories is because they tend to be sticky and a little bit more indelible. And certainly, yes, they might settle over a period of time, but sometimes they stick a bit more. And that's when people are more susceptible to post-traumatic stress disorder. They're persistent at quite some level of distress. They stay quite frequent. Well, here's the challenging situation. If people want to reduce the frequency and the intensity of those memories, the chances are they're going to have to relive them, go through the feared memory, facing the feared memory, exposing oneself to the feared memory again and again and again or over a period of time to help defuse its emotional impact, to help lessen its intensity, lessen its impact. And in this sense, it's a little bit like dealing with phobic anxiety generally. If people have a fear of heights, basically at some level, you need eventually to get up at a certain height, maybe look down, that kind of thing, and learn to manage the feelings. If people have a fear of spiders, quite frankly, they might need to encounter a spider in some shape or form and then find that they can withstand that experience to the point where their anxiety will eventually come down. So we understand this with phobias. Basically, we have to face the situation until our anxiety comes down. Well, exposure-based therapy involves therapy principles that help people manage with this. They help bring up the memory in quite a vivid way, but also using strategies that help the person stay with it until the distress comes down in the memory, until it lessens in its intensity, even while a person still has the memory in mind, and then the person learns to have less fear of that particular memory, and a number of other reactions tend to settle, a number of other PTSD reactions tend to settle when the trauma memory is defused. It's less frequent, less intense, doesn't last as long.
And that's where I suppose it really helps to recognise that maybe the origin of these memories is part of a survival instinct. So it's not as if we've got anything wrong with this if we're experiencing something like this. In some ways, it maybe seems that we're functioning as well as we probably could to alert ourselves of particular situations which are going to cause us danger or distress. So I suppose that's one thing just to keep in mind as we talk about this. But I suppose the first question I have, Dad, is how can we identify a traumatic memory as opposed to maybe just a regular memory otherwise?
Okay, well, one of the first things is when the person realises that they're feeling ongoing distress about a past traumatic event. A traumatic event meaning a situation was very challenging at the time. The person might have felt intense fear or horror in the situation. They might have felt quite helpless. They might have felt that their life was at threat, or otherwise they witnessed someone else who faced a very life-threatening situation. And in that particular situation, it evokes these fight, flight, freeze kind of reactions that we associate with the survival instinct, as you mentioned, and where these memories stay somewhat stuck or persistent. So some of the ways that I think people can identify it is how frequently does the memory come up? With trauma memories associated with PTSD, they would typically come up at least a couple of times a month. There would usually be some distress associated with a memory coming up. I would say on a 10-point scale, if 10's the worst you've ever felt and 0's no distress, at least around about like a 5, a moderate level of distress, and often it will be a 7 or 8 or 9 out of 10 when a trauma memory is evoked. And then how long does it last? If it's just a couple of seconds that someone thinks of a former car accident, for example, and then it readily passes out of mind, then that's a more fleeting thing and it's maybe not such a problem. But if it only lasts a few seconds, but it's very intense and it comes up several times in a day, then that still could be a trauma memory. But certainly if a memory tends to linger for quite some time. And for a number of people, it'll linger for minutes, or people might even have a flashback, meaning it's almost like a dream while you're awake and this memory comes back into one's mind as though you're almost back there in that situation. Sometimes that could persist with people having distress afterwards for, well, I know one war veteran, for example, he'd be lying down on a couch for a couple of hours after he had a flashback because it had such an impact for him. So part of it is how frequent, how intense and how long the memory lasts. But basically, it's a memory that's very distressing, unwanted. It triggers certain kind of feelings that evoke the previous trauma situation. And the other thing about a trauma memory, they'll explain a little bit more, but it's not just what you heard or what you saw, what you felt, but the memory also stores certain kind of reactions that we have to the situation that can be triggered as well.
And I'm interested in that language, triggered, like something maybe that's come up a little bit more in the last couple of years. Like this is language that exists a little bit more in popular culture now, but this idea of something being triggered seems to suggest that there's maybe a involuntary response to a particular stimulus. And as we say, that it's something that comes up, you know, a little bit these days about, say, even, you know, trigger warnings and all this sort of stuff. And I suppose in some ways this is what it's trying to allude to. But it seems to me with what we're talking about with traumatic memories, it's maybe, say, a little bit more intense than, you know, just coming across maybe something on the internet that you don't like, seeing said in a particular way, and then that quote unquote triggers you. It seems that there's maybe a different level of intensity with what we're talking about in terms of actual trauma memories.
Yes, that's an important distinction to make. And yes, sometimes people can loosely use the term triggered, like someone said something they didn't like and the person had, say, an unwanted reaction to that, or they might have felt that their reaction was maybe somewhat more intense or exaggerated beyond what they might have expected. And it would be using the term a bit loosely to describe the term triggered. And I just heard recently someone use a different word that I think is more fitting for that situation, when they say that, in a sense, they were activated by some kind of event or some situation. I think that makes more sense for the more colloquial term. Something happened that, in a sense, got a reaction out of you and you felt somewhat like activated by that, or it had an impact on you. But when we use the word triggered with trauma memories, yes, it is like a sudden, very involuntary reaction that the person had. And I'll just mention, it does help to understand how trauma memories work, to pick up on this triggering notion, because then you can make sense of it. Trauma memories have three components to it. There's the stimulus aspect, so what you saw, heard and felt at the time, what you took in through your senses. So if someone, for example, held up a bank, someone's wearing a balaclava, they've got a gun with them, then the stimulus part of the memory will be what we saw, heard, felt. It might be seeing a glint of the gun barrel, for example. It might be, again, the colour of the person's balaclava is more imprinted on our mind. It might be partly the setting itself. It was our local neighbourhood bank that we were used to going to again and again and again. These are all parts of the stimulus aspect of the memory. Now, there are also other parts like response parts. What if the time we just dive down to the ground? So involuntarily, we just dive down and basically hit the deck when we saw this person coming in with a gun. That also could be stored in our memory and associated with that. But another thing that can be stored in our memory is the meaning of the situation. And the meaning to us at the time might be, my gosh, like the world's unsafe. Like, here I am in my usual bank and, hey, the world's unsafe. If I can't be safe here, where can I be safe? My own neighbourhood's unsafe. This is unpredictable. And, hey, look, I can't do anything to change this situation. I'm just stuck. I'm helpless here. I'm trapped. Now, what that means is the stimulus aspect, the response aspect, the meaning aspect, if any of those elements are triggered by a future similar situation, the person can have the other feelings come up. For example, if they walk into that bank again, we can understand that stimulus, seeing the exact bank, could bring up feelings of panic and could bring up this sense that the person has, this meaning, oh, look, I'm not safe. I can't feel safe anywhere. But a memory can also be triggered if a response aspect comes up. Like, just say someone feels panicky in a particular situation, or maybe their heart's beating really fast. They might have just engaged in some exercise or run along the street. Their heart beating fast or the feeling panicky can be a reminder of when they felt panicky in the bank. And it could bring back feelings of being nervous and unsafe and feeling helpless. But it also could be in any situation where a person feels helpless. They could have just found out that they lost their job. They've just become redundant and they don't have any control over that. Well, then they might start having more dreams of being in the bank holdup, for example. Now, the thing is, any aspect of the memory that gets triggered, anything which is very similar to the memory, can evoke the other parts of a trauma memory. So here are just a couple of other classic examples. A war veteran goes on holiday in Fiji, and he wonders, why is it I started feeling really panicky when I'm on this boat and we're traveling to a tropical island? Well, it turns out, later on, we figured out the vegetation of the island reminded him of the vegetation he encountered in Vietnam. It was enough to evoke panicky events in him. Another elderly fellow I know, he started to develop more trauma symptoms after he had been down the street and a young woman tried to pick his pocket, take a wallet out of his pocket. And then he started having these nightmares about his much earlier war trauma from World War II. Well, there he was in his local neighbourhood, and suddenly someone tries to pick his pocket and he's thinking, hey, I can't be safe in my own late neighbourhood. So it evokes memories of when he previously couldn't have felt safe. That was World War II. So he starts having more memories and bad dreams of World War II. So anything that triggers one aspect of the memory can trigger others. So just say, for example, someone could be walking on the street, and this would happen with a number of war veterans, a car would backfire and they'd dive down to the ground. Or it could be I mentioned with the Vietnam veterans, a number of people described they had difficulty walking down a certain street in Footscray where there are a number of Vietnamese butchers, and they remembered the smell of the butchers they encountered in Vietnam, and it would trigger these panicky kind of feelings. So it's anything that can evoke the memory can lead to that kind of reaction. And once you understand that a memory has these different elements, it's the stimulus, what we see and heard, it's the response, it's the meaning of it, then you can understand maybe why you encounter someone maybe in a ski queue with a black balaclava and you feel very nervous. Oh, it helps if you understand that might remind me of the person in the bank with a black balaclava, for example. So once we understand that these memories can be triggered, well, it also makes sense that we want to defuse this process. And the best way of doing that is to deliberately, in a therapy setting, again and again and again, going through certain trauma memories in a way again and again and again, we're facing it again and again and again, lessens their impact, like facing another phobic situation.
And so this might be a bit of a simplification, but it seems to me that we'd say, like, traumatic memories, there's potentially an external aspect to it. So we might be in a situation that reminds us of the traumatic memory almost externally. There could be an internal aspect to it. So we might be experiencing the same set of feelings and physiological responses within us, which reminds us of that other situation that we're in. And then almost maybe this, say, like, meta aspect to it, where if we almost analyze the situation a particular way and we're reminded of that particular analysis, like, for example, saying, you know, the world is unsafe, and then we're reminded that the world is unsafe, then that again can remind us of that particular traumatic situation. But it strikes me that with all these examples, there's maybe an aspect to which your worldview almost gets blown apart in a way. And then, so in the future, you get reminders of maybe how your worldview and perspective was so violently shook in a particular way. And then that can almost put you back into the situation where your worldview is getting kind of shaken up in that particular context.
Yes, that's a very good way of putting it. I think one of the main things that you encounter with people who have severe trauma reactions is it's like the bottom has fallen out of their world. What otherwise would seem predictable no longer seems that way. Someone's happily been living in their environment in the bush, or they're on holidays somewhere, and then this terrible fire comes ripping through the place and they've lost everything from that situation. Someone's walking in a nearby park in their own neighbourhood and they get assaulted, even in broad daylight. And I think, just that's not meant to happen in that way. A young person, well, it could be a person of any age, goes and sees their doctor for a checkup, and then they get terrible news about a potentially fatal diagnosis. All of these things can turn your world upside down. All these things can lead to the bottom dropping out of your world. And there's an aspect of it which is to do with helplessness. Because these kind of experiences, they have that extra, well, I suppose, potential to confront us that we don't have so much control over our lives as we might like to think that we do. It's kind of like, there but by the grace of God go I. If I was crossing the intersection at that time, it might have been me in the car where another truck came through and collected you, another car came through and collected you. Like recently, there were people coming home from a wedding on a bus. Who would have thought that a number of people would be killed in that kind of situation? So it does lead to this real shaking up of our view of the world for many people, and that can persist further, and people are a little bit more at risk of that depending on their views in the first place. If people either have views in the first place that, hey, I'm a very vulnerable person, there's a lot in my life I can't control or influence, I'm often feeling chaotic, then people are more at risk of trauma reactions. But similarly, if someone thinks, no, nothing will get to me, I'm able to handle any challenging situation. It used to happen in the Stoic professions, like certainly police, soldiers, prison officers, those more Stoic kind of cultures, if you like. People were more at risk of developing PTSD because they had this view, well, I shouldn't be vulnerable, I should be above this. Whereas, well, the more healthy view is I can manage in most situations I encounter. I can influence my life in a lot of ways. The world is a relatively safe kind of place, but also things can happen beyond my control. Doesn't mean it's my fault, but again, there's an element of luck that comes into that, and I just hope that if the time comes, I can find ways of managing that, have whatever support, get by it in some way, but not having the attitude that basically you're above being impacted by traumatic events.
Which is the sort of thing, like, as we describe this, like, it in some ways makes so much sense in terms of, like, as humans, like, much of our cognition is based around, for example, pattern recognition. And so if you go through an event or experience something which completely you have zero pattern recognition for, and it potentially even leads you to reassess some of the patterns that you have recognized in the world, well, you can see why that would, I suppose, really, you know, at a basic level, confuse someone about, I suppose, what they think about the world. Like, especially when you tie it to, for example, say, survival instincts, where even if something happens, you know, once, we're still set up in a way that's going to allow us to recognize that single event as a pattern and look out for it again. And I suppose it just makes a lot more sense once we start talking about things in this way. But what I then wonder is, so, like, talking about something like PTSD, which is, again, something that we hear a little bit about in say, popular culture, but again, it seems to maybe take on its own meaning in psychology, its more precise meaning. I wonder if we could almost think about PTSD as the accumulation of some of these memories that cause us to be triggered in a situation.
Okay, now this is a very important issue because whereas I think that trauma memories are at the core of PTSD, like we're saying, it's partly through survival instinct. We're meant to remember these situations which are a threat. It helps our evolution and survival that these memories can stand out in certain ways. But there are many other aspects to post-traumatic stress disorder reactions other than just the memories themselves. And so it helps to understand, first of all, there are three different dimensions of PTSD. One is the intrusive thoughts. So it's a bit like the intrusive thoughts or images or pictures or dreams, these intrusive kind of symptoms. It's a little bit like the mind's way of saying, look, you got to keep on making sense of this situation. Like, you're still having dreams about being assaulted, or you're still having these flashbacks about a war experience or a sexual assault. It's like your mind's kind of like knocking on a door saying, look, come on, you've got to, you know, it's like knocking on a door saying, look, you've got to actually process this. You've got to revisit this. There's something that's not worked through at the moment. So the intrusions probably have a purpose to try and work through this aspect of one's experience that doesn't make sense. How does this fit into my life? I've got this feeling this shouldn't be happening, that kind of thing. It shouldn't have happened. Now, the thing is, the intrusions are accompanied by what we call hyperarousal symptoms or anxiety-related symptoms because it's associated with this distress and maybe life-threatening situations naturally, horrific traumatic situations. It'll affect things like our concentration maybe, our irritability, our body might be more reactive, like say tight or more panic kind of reaction, certainly sleep being disrupted. So basically it's got these kind of hyperarousal or anxiety-related symptoms that overlap with panic-type symptoms. But also because the intrusions are uncomfortable and the feelings that come with them are very uncomfortable, people try and block it out in different ways, like they try and put it out of their mind. And that's where people develop what we call the avoidance symptoms of PTSD. And they've got a couple of aspects to it. One is the deliberate trying to not think about something. Like, I'll not go and see a movie because I know that there's a car crash in it and I don't want to be reminded of my car crash, or it involves assault or a bank robbery or something like that. So people deliberately try and avoid thinking about the situation. They avoid reminders, like they don't go to that neighbourhood in which they encountered a trauma, like they don't go back to that bank, or might even steer clear of that whole part of the neighbourhood. People also tend to have less social contact for a period of time. And so they don't engage with other people as much. They're at risk of becoming a little bit more withdrawn. But there's also another kind of avoidance that can be a little bit unconscious in a sense, like numbing. People can feel more blunted in their emotions or more numbed. And that can be actually quite a painful experience. The person can feel a bit detached from themselves. So it's not just the memories. It's also like the social withdrawal and avoidance for many people. It's trying not to think about situations. It's the phobic avoidance that comes up with situations. People also can have a sense of a foreshortened future, feeling that they won't live as long in future, their sleep being disrupted, being more irritable. So there's a range of reactions. And now, this would be understandable, when people have those reactions, they can also have additional reactions like depression. Many of the people that we see with post-traumatic stress disorder, especially if it's lingering and quite intense, will also be depressed. They might have other anxiety reactions like generalized anxiety disorder, or they might become avoidant more generally of a range of situations. So the PTSD is often compounded by other problems. Another common one being substance abuse. The person might be self-medicating for their anxiety. They might be using alcohol a lot, as many war veterans did. People might be using other kind of drugs as well to try and reduce the pain or numb or avoid the pain. And so that's where a number of people, where their trauma might be identified, is if they actually approach a substance abuse clinic or they're dealing with an addiction. And if they're dealing with therapists who are aware of there commonly being a trauma reaction behind someone having an addiction, for example. Or it might be with depression. People present with depression and a therapist might be picking up again that the person's had some trauma background. So experienced therapists will be looking for trauma and trauma reactions in a sense regardless of why people present. And certainly if people present with a recurrent depression or numbed feelings, or we've talked before about dissociative disorders, which commonly are triggered by repeated trauma, especially in childhood, might be childhood sexual abuse, but other trauma reactions can lead to dissociation, which is almost like a kind of detachment or numbing. The person might feel like they're outside their body, which we call depersonalization, a strategy which is almost trying to, again, reduce the feeling of pain from being in their own skin with their own memory, so to speak. So dissociative disorders, substance use problems, recurrent depression, maybe persistent anxiety and panic that comes up in different kind of ways. Now, not uncommonly, not saying most of the time, but in quite a proportion of cases, there'll be some kind of trauma background, and experienced therapists will look for the trauma. Use the term, cherche le trauma, look for the trauma. Because if you can find trauma reactions with trauma memories attached that can be evoked more readily and defuse them using exposure-based techniques, then typically the person will improve in their depression, their panic reactions, and be in a better position to deal with the substance abuse and the dissociation, the other problems.
And so then how do we treat trauma memories with exposure therapy? Because there's a couple of things that come to mind as you're explaining that. Like the first is that talking about, for example, intrusions, avoidance, hyperarousal, like there's potentially a survival aspect to those three reactions in terms of the intrusions are letting us know that, hey, this is something that happened. It's very dangerous. We want to avoid that situation again in the future. Avoidance, well, that seems to be trying to avoid those stimulus aspects, the response aspects, and the meaning aspects that we spoke about earlier when these memories can be triggered. And then the hyperarousal, well, that's just fight, flight, freeze, submit in terms of there seems to be some benefit to our response in those particular situations. And what I then wonder is there a risk that I suppose will induce PTSD if we too readily put ourselves in a situation that will trigger a traumatic memory? Because part of PTSD seems to be going through these memories themselves and having them come up again for us. How is that different to going through exposure in a therapeutic context?
Okay, well, the main problem is when the trauma memories come up or they're triggered unbidden. So the person's maybe going about their life in a certain way and then these disruptive memories or reactions come up, or they've got the lingering feelings of panic, or otherwise they do have a depressive condition, or they've developed problems with substance abuse, that kind of thing. They're these ongoing kind of difficulties. But as you say, they've developed out of something which is understandable. It's partly the mind and body recognizing to these kind of survival mechanisms in different ways. But the point is with trauma memories, when they linger as post-traumatic stress disorder, is they've become somewhat stuck. So the person's processing of the memory is not proceeding to the point where day after day after day they find that they're relatively safe again, and so this sense of the danger having passed. It's still somewhat sticky, and this is unplanned, it's unwanted. And look, I should mention as well, about two-thirds of people, after most types of traumatic experiences, will have like a relatively good recovery and relatively spontaneous recovery. Like with many people, within something like 6 to 8 weeks, you'd look at a lot of the initial reactions to settle in terms of intrusions and the panicky kind of feelings, or feeling like avoiding situations or not being so socially engaged. For most people, within about 6 to 8 weeks, a lot of this will be improving. And if it's continuing beyond that point, or if it's quite intense, or it's disrupting people's relationships because they're having more arguments, they're more irritable, or they're using substances, that's more of a sign that this is lingering a little bit further. And we only diagnose PTSD if these reactions have been continuing more than 1 month. Because for many people, they will start settling more in the initial weeks. But again, for a proportion of people who experience trauma, and it will have been, say, one quarter of Vietnam War veterans, for example, and another quarter again, so up to 50%, if they didn't have the full level of PTSD, it would have been something approaching that, what we'd call subclinical PTSD. So that's a whole lot of people who are in a war theatre who develop those reactions, or it might be, say, two-thirds of people who were imprisoned and tortured as prisoners of war. Naturally, that would be a higher proportion again. Or people have experienced a severe rape and their life was at threat. Naturally, it'll be a higher proportion in those situations. But in other situations, for example, if people witnessed a gunman at large, and especially if they weren't, say, in the line of fire or so directly at risk, then it might be more like 10%. So it varies on the intensity of the situation, but still, many people will have some level of spontaneous recovery. About two-thirds of people are going to recover fairly well in the long run. And something we might even talk about later on is post-traumatic growth. A number of people after a very challenging event, especially when they're fully recovered, will see things that they've gained from the situation. We might come back to talk about that later on, a greater sense of meaning or priorities in life, different kind of things, being grateful for how things are in their life when they're through that distressing experience, the different positive things that can come that way. But I suppose to get back to the key thing here, the difference between, say, exposure therapy of deliberately working through these memories rather than just having them come up as like flashbacks or intrusive thoughts is when people deliberately relive these experiences in a therapy setting, it's not unbidden, it's planned. It's a little bit like people planning to deal with phobic anxiety generally and face their fear and face the discomfort in their body and find ways of getting through it. So the difference is in the, if you like, the relative control or planfulness or the predictability or the ways of going about a kind of deliberate exposure, which more predictably will reduce the anxiety level, because there are things in therapy which help that happen.
And so it seems that a big element of exposure therapy is, for example, a very controlled environment like you mentioned there. Like, what I wonder with exposure therapy is, I wonder if there's maybe a sense of, say, building it up, because from what you're describing there, I wonder if it's almost like the very first place that we would expose ourselves to that traumatic memory would be in the most quote-unquote controlled environment possible. We'd even control maybe the level of exposure. Like, I wonder if maybe you could even, for example, just imagine a traumatic situation, and then it's almost like, well, okay, start, that's really tough to do, but as we go through time, it's a little bit easier and a little bit easier. And then maybe you could look at a video related to that traumatic memory, and then maybe you could go and visit the situation. But I wonder if there's maybe this sense of kind of slowly building up the exposure in almost like, say, more and more controlled environments. So we almost learn maybe a set of, say, skills in how to deal with that particular memory for those times when it does come up a bit more uncontrolled. Is that kind of the basic principle, to basically try and control the exposure as much as possible? Then we feel comfortable in that environment, look to build on that a little bit into a situation we have even maybe a little bit of less control. And then by the end of doing that and going through that process, we can be in situations that maybe don't feel much control at all, still have memories of that traumatic event, and it's not so distressing for us.
Okay, that's a lot about how it can happen, but when it boils down to it, these are some of the key principles. And so you're quite right. In therapy, we look for a more controlled or predictable environment for people to face their memories. But the first thing to acknowledge is when we're doing exposure therapy for trauma and especially post-traumatic stress disorder, basically it's looking for the person to remember the very worst experiences of their life, the most frightening experiences of their life. So a number of people like the war veterans at Heidelberg, when we introduced this post-traumatic stress disorder program, actually at first some of them were angry. They're saying, why are you trying to get us to remember these war experiences? After all, for 25 years plus, that's all we've been trying to forget. So why do that? It just causes us pain and distress. And that's where, at the start, we need some kind of rationale, which is partly what we're looking at in this podcast, the kind of rationale we'd give for this kind of therapy, but also to say, yes, there are safeguards built into what we do. There are planful ways of helping make this a more manageable process. But the first principle is this, with exposure. And just like with phobic anxiety, facing a fear, what needs to happen is for the person to face the feared situation in a way that their anxiety comes down very significantly even while they're still there. So basically that means that people will face the memory, have memories in mind of their experience, their war experience, car accident, an assault, to have the memories in mind and have their anxiety come down. Now, there are a few things that can help this happen, but this process of having one's anxiety come down, we call it habituation. It's a fairly natural process that happens. Like if someone had a fear of heights and they got up at a high building and they looked down, if they were there for an hour and a half, it's almost certain that their fear would habituate, meaning that over a period of time, their fear would gradually become less. At first, their fear might be 9 or 10 out of 10. But it wouldn't be surprising if after an hour or so, their fear was no more than about a 4 or a 5 or something like that, just simply from staying in the situation for a period of time, and then in a sense, nothing terrible is happening and that gradually sinking in. But it's pretty harsh just to look to, if you like, you know, grit your teeth and just sort of stick it out kind of thing and just wait for painful feelings to come down. So in exposure-based therapy, first of all, we help prepare people by having some anxiety management techniques in the first place. The method is going to involve the person deliberately reliving some kind of memories. So first of all, we might introduce something like relaxation techniques or mindfulness techniques and particularly breathing techniques, and looking at what else the person does in their everyday life that can help bring down their arousal level. But breathing techniques really help, and something that helps relax the muscles in our body. For some people, it's meditation, yoga, but certainly relaxation techniques and mindfulness techniques are helpful. We would also often help the person learn to imagine being in a safe place. That usually means the person forming an image of being in a calm and peaceful kind of place. Now, if the person can actually manage their arousal level so they can drop their arousal level, if they're maybe distressed to a point of 8 out of 10, but through slow breathing even bring it back to like a 6 out of 10 over a period of, you know, like say a minute or so, the person already knows that they've got a way of helping bring down their distress levels. But the person being a bit prepared with relaxation techniques, with breathing techniques, then I think, like you're saying, many exposure techniques will build up to feared memories. So if it is, for example, a person remembering certain kinds of war experience, then they might remember some of the less threatening yet still challenging situations before they look to remember the more threatening, the more distressing situations. So we develop what we would call a fear hierarchy. The lesser challenging situations you'd approach first, then you'd build up to the more challenging situations. You'd only progress to the more challenging situation after the person could manage, if you like, a less challenging memory, and maybe using some kind of breathing techniques or relaxation techniques at the time. And that's actually what we call a technique, systematic desensitization. Systematic desensitization, which was also developed for phobias, is you approach a challenging situation step by step, like you were suggesting earlier, but you also combine it with, say, slow breathing or a relaxation technique, which counters the kind of anxiety and panic reactions. So habituation is anything that just helps you hang in the situation for long enough that your anxiety comes down. Systematic desensitization is specifically planning step by step, facing gradually increasing situations, and maybe using relaxation techniques as well. Well, for myself and many therapists, we would use as a standard exposure technique. The person's well prepared, they've got a rationale for the therapy. We would ask them to start describing an event. It might be a car accident. So as they're driving towards the intersection, and then they might say, even in the first person present, and now I'm entering the intersection and I can see a car coming from the right. And then suddenly there's a screech of brakes. And then now I can hear a big bang. And like the person's telling a narrative in the first person present themselves and going through that. And then if the person, and we'd only do that therapy if the person was up for it and they knew what they were doing, they knew they could be uncomfortable, and again, they've done anxiety management kind of, you know, preparation, they've got strategies they can use at home, they might even have a relaxation recording that they can use to help them manage at home, that kind of thing. But the person goes through that situation again and again and again, that scenario again and again and again. We also have variations where the person might talk through a traumatic experience in the third person. They might say, and then John was driving through the intersection. Or then, and Jane saw a car come from the right. And then suddenly there's a screech of brakes. There's an aspect of telling the event and a narrative of the trauma in the third person. It builds in a little bit more detachment. Now, there are a whole range of techniques that the therapist can use, like going from a less challenging part of the memory to a more challenging part of the memory, telling the narrative bit by bit, like a narrative sequence, for example, of a car accident. But the person knows that any time they can stop, the therapist has already brought in this thing that the person can raise their hand at any time if things are becoming very uncomfortable, there can be a pause. The therapist is noticing how the person's responding at the time. If they seem very aroused or distressed, there's always a way of pausing at that time, bring in some breathing techniques, that kind of thing. But basically, exposure techniques involve often at least, at very least, some kind of pictures or images in mind of an event, talking about the event in some way, and very often it'll be describing a narrative of the event, a story in a sequence, often in first person. There's other tricks we can use, like third person, using breathing techniques, but the point is the person goes through their story. And the key kind of thing is the person goes through it again and again and again and then finds that their anxiety or their arousal level does come down. Now, if we have therapy sessions of around about, say, 1 hour, then we can often see that there's at least 20 minutes, half an hour longer, need be, to go through these exposure exercises. People would sometimes continue the exposure homework at home. They might have made a recording on their phone of going through this narrative of a challenging situation, and they play that back again and again and again at home, again using breathing techniques, relaxation techniques to manage it, and the person finds that this habituation relatively predictably occurs in most situations. It's when the client's ready for it, the therapist thinks this is an appropriate time to do it in the course of therapy, the person's well prepared. It helps often if the person's partner or family members know they're going through this challenging process because it can bring up anxiety at the time. Naturally, over, say, 2 or 3 exposure sessions, if the person is maybe, you know, going home after these sessions, there might be more memories in mind, and we might encourage the person to maybe keep a notebook and just note down what kind of reactions they're having afterwards. We use questionnaire measures to closely monitor how people are going, and what you tend to see in the vast majority of situations is people's anxiety and distress levels will come down. It really helps if the therapist is experienced in trauma reactions, is confident in using these exposure therapy techniques, because the therapist will have that trust from seeing again and again and again. We call it putting it in your trust bank. You've seen it again and again and again. People can go to these very uncomfortable memories, go through it again and again and again, have strategies to help the anxiety come down, even whilst thinking of the very challenging situation, and you tend to get this habituation, this lessening of anxiety. When people feel that lessening of anxiety, they notice that's more predictable, and they feel more confidence of managing that kind of situation, then usually they're more ready to face some challenging reminders, what we call in vivo, in real life, not just imagination. They're more likely to go back to that bank, drive through that intersection, or get back driving again. They might watch news items, even though that there's a chance that they'll encounter a story about a sexual assault, for example. So you find there's less avoidance that happens at that stage. And that kind of ongoing exposure, less avoidance in everyday life, that further builds up the person's confidence to go on.
And I wonder if it's a good point to mention here as well. Like, it strikes me that this is probably something that is worth doing with a therapist, as opposed to, for example, feeling like, you know, oh, I just want to move forward in a particular way. I feel up to it in this, you know, situation. And so maybe going off and doing your own version of this could strike me that, well, you could put yourself in a position where you really are triggered again, and then it's maybe not so helpful if we go through this process and we're not able to do it in a way that's controlled and can help us maybe progress and experience that habituation a little bit more. Like, I wonder what your thoughts are there in terms of whether, you know, it is something that really is best done with a therapist, or whether there are maybe aspects that we could do on our own.
Okay, well, look, in many ways, after people have gone through a significant trauma, like it might be a bushfire, for example, a life-threatening bushfire, many houses were lost and the person at some stage feared for their life and others in their community. Now, to some extent, just actually being in that environment itself is going to be, if people continue living in their environment, if their house wasn't burned down, for example, many people in the community are still there, there's an exposure element that's happening quite naturally at that time, which is also quite helpful. And quite frankly, in the early days after trauma, what's often most important is that people draw on their usual social networks. So straight after a trauma like a bushfire, people's natural support networks are the most important, far more important than a therapist at that stage or whatever. People in their communities looking to get back to normal life as much as possible. And actually, most people will recover pretty well from most traumatic kind of events if they can engage in their everyday life in an ongoing way, which will involve natural elements of exposure. Like, a person maybe goes back to a bank the following week where there was maybe a hold up the week before or something like that. Now, but what we're talking about here partly is when people have had more significant difficulties, say, to do with post-traumatic stress disorder, especially if it's been lingering for quite some time. If it's been lingering for many months, it's quite severe. The person has a lot of distress. Like, one of the ways of gauging that is if people are still having bad dreams about a past traumatic event. That's a clue for post-traumatic stress disorder. If the person's having flashbacks during the day, images that are disruptive, if it's got an ongoing impact on their relationships, their irritability, they're having more arguments, things like that, substance abuse, those kind of things. If that's continuing over a period of months and the person recognises that when they turn their mind to that particular event or when they're reminded of it, they feel quite disrupted and they're feeling stuck with that, and that memory isn't lessening so much, say, spontaneously. So that's where it's more in that post-traumatic stress disorder territory. That's when it especially helps to see a therapist. So many people will recover well from traumatic situations without seeing a therapist. And there'll be some natural elements of, if you like, exposure or facing things in their everyday life and reminders, including people asking them how they're going since that car accident or robbery or whatever it might be. But if people feel stuck with that, it's not improving so much, it's more severe, more disruptive, then definitely I think often people will really benefit from seeing a therapist, because most people then can make very significant progress, certainly within 10 sessions. And the exposure-based therapy might be, say, something like 2 or 3 sessions of that. And this includes if people have faced trauma memories that go back like several years And people might be stuck with that because actually there's usually some spontaneous recovery over about 2 years, a little bit further over about 6 years. Beyond that, not much spontaneous recovery at all. If people have problems going back for quite a number of years, that would also be a sign it's probably worth seeing a therapist to make much change from there. There probably won't be so much spontaneous change at that stage.
And so I'm interested in this aspect of when it is particularly severe and disruptive, because it strikes me there could be a whole range of issues associated with that situation. And one thing that we've spoken about in previous episodes is when people dissociate. And that's related to trauma memories. It's to do with maybe a form of self-hypnosis to avoid a particular exposure to a traumatic situation. And then maybe they train themselves to step out of their immediate physical environment in that situation so they're not so pointedly, for lack of a better term, experiencing that trauma, whatever it is. How does someone dissociating affect their ability to go through exposure therapy? Because is it the case where someone may have become stuck with a particular situation, find themselves dissociating, does this then affect their ability to recall the memories in a way that's needed to go through exposure therapy?
Okay, look, that's a really interesting question. It's worth adding some things on dissociation because actually that's one of the ways that people are more likely to develop, like say, trauma memories and PTSD. There are two main pathways to PTSD because, again, most people are going to recover reasonably well from a traumatic event. But two main pathways. One is if people experience very intense anxiety at the time of the trauma. So if people go into, for example, an emergency department and if their heart rate is monitored, people who have a very high heart rate after a traumatic situation such as a car accident are more likely to develop PTSD. But there's another pathway as well, and that's dissociation. If people have had prominent dissociative symptoms at the time of the trauma, for example, they experience themselves as outside their body at the time of the trauma. They're looking on as though they're looking at another person. So that's the depersonalization. Or there's amnesia. There's significant aspects of an event that they don't remember. Like, for example, they're encountered by someone with a gun and they don't remember key details of that kind of event, if there's amnesia. And another thing can be derealization, meaning the person feels as though things aren't real. It's as though they're living in a dream at the time. If people have those dissociative symptoms at the time of the trauma, the chances are this is from feeling overwhelmed, and so one's senses and one's mind can't take it all in at once, feeling overwhelmed. And so this spilling over of extra stimulation, it's like a bucket being filled up and spilling over the edge, if you like. It's not so contained, the person can't, you know, hold it together in their memories. And so that's where people are more at risk of these trauma memories, and one of the helpful things of going back and telling a narrative is people can piece together a little bit more of a whole story or a thread of a story, or put more pieces together that makes a little bit more sense. It hangs together as a story that can help deal with it. But also, one other thing that can happen, you mentioned hypnosis. Yes, if people are spontaneously dissociating, like, for example, they see themselves outside of their body, then that could be part of the mind's way of trying to buffer oneself from pain. It's almost like I'm not in my body. The other thing that we can do with people in that situation with exposure is teach them to deliberately use hypnosis techniques, in a sense, some kind of dissociative type techniques, but using hypnosis deliberately to defuse its impact. So, for example, we can have the person imagine that they're watching a movie screen and seeing themselves on a movie screen in that situation where they have some kind of detachment from themselves. That might help them manage with it. But we can also use other hypnosis tricks. One way of lessening the distress of exposure is the person images, they see an image or a movie of the situation that they're in, but they look at it as though they're looking through a telescope backwards. So it's a little circle in the distance of that image that often dials it down. Or we use the metaphor of a rheostat, you know, like so the light bulb dimmer. So you imagine the scene and now you dim it, you gradually dim it. So halfway, and then gradually dim it right down, and then sort of dial it up again a bit and then dim it down. So the person feels that little bit of control. Or otherwise, the person can imagine seeing their traumatic experience unfold, but it's on a movie screen behind their head. So got the idea of it being projected onto a movie screen, but they're not even having to see it. It's the notion of it being behind their head. In other words, there are tricks that we can use in a therapy setting that help defuse that impact of the more direct exposure to the memories, if you like. It includes also the person tells the narrative in the third person, like you said, step by step building up to it. It can include also telling a 3 or a 5 minute story, including an aspect of the trauma, and just going through that bit again and again and again, and maybe not even going to the worst aspect of the trauma at that particular time, building up to it. So these are all different strategies or techniques, but the core of it is being prepared to face the feared memories and facing them in a way that the person experiences the heat coming from it. The heat coming from it enough that they have more confidence of managing with it. And we're generally looking for the person's anxiety level to drop to no more than half of what it was at its peak. And certainly it's an advantage if people's anxiety or distress level gets down to something like no more than a 1 or 2 out of 10, even when they remember the painful memory. It doesn't have to be that, but that can help if it gets right down to that, which in many situations it does.
And so it strikes me with when talking about, say, traumatic memories, it can almost be a little bit like being in a car. And we talk about, say, for example, hyperarousal and this stuff. Like, it's almost like the traumatic memory is like the accelerator of the car. As you say, it's going to heat us up. It's going to, you know, get us moving fast, for lack of a better term. It strikes me with exposure therapy, almost what we're trying to do in the situation is to add brakes to that car. So that it's not as if we're just going to get in the car and it's all accelerated and we're just going to shoot straight forward, you know, off into the distance. Well, maybe we can use some things like breathing techniques, some relaxation techniques, like some of those techniques that you were describing there, almost like perspectival techniques, for lack of a better term. It's almost like they're the brakes that's going to stop us just zooming straight ahead, straight into the heat of that traumatic memory. And exposure therapy is really about, okay, what's a way that we can apply the brakes in this situation so we can almost, you know, slowly build up to that situation where eventually the car is going at full speed, but it just means that we don't have to go from, you know, 0 to 100. We've got a way to slowly build up and feel in control of the car at all times as well.
Yes, and I think especially if we look at it as control being a relative thing, it's just basically the person feels that they have enough resources to manage with it to get by, and a whole lot of that is the relationship between the client and the therapist, having trust in the therapist that they know what they're doing. And so it's very important in any therapy, so much of the outcome of the therapy follows on from the quality of that kind of relationship. And as you'd understand, trauma therapy involving exposure, it's sometimes referred to as a conversation between limbic systems. So limbic system, that's the client's fight-flight response. It's when the amygdala is triggered. So this fight-flight-freeze kind of reaction, this survival mechanism, that's based on the limbic system that all animals have that help escape challenging situations or fight off an attacker. Now, the thing with that is the person's limbic system will certainly be activated when we're going through trauma memories. And for a therapist, it's important to be able to manage and tolerate that as well. As a therapist, you have to be used to the idea that we're going about sessions in a way that, again, the person is facing a really uncomfortable situation. It's a fearful kind of situation. And the therapist has to manage with their reactions in that, be well attuned to the client, and to have that collaboration between them, where the therapist also, by managing their reactions and recognizing when the person needs a pause, or again, there could be a focus more on breathing techniques, or slow it down a little bit, or bring in some other kind of strategy to help ease the heat of it. That's where some of that partial control comes in. But the other thing is the understanding what it's about. And that's where this podcast is designed to help people understand the rationales for exposure therapy. Because if people can understand it, well, I suppose it's like going to the dentist. If we understand what might be behind some of these uncomfortable procedures, we're going to much more confidently subject ourselves to that, especially if we've got confidence in the dentist. And so I think it's a little bit like that. We know it might well be painful or uncomfortable in some ways, but there's a real benefit that can come afterwards. And then, look, quite frankly, it's setting aside the time, finding a time when the person's ready to do that, hopefully not too much disruptive happening in the person's life, or they're otherwise ready to deal with this now, that a lot of the trauma therapy sessions based on exposure can be maybe scheduled over about a 2-week period. There might be 2 or 3 sessions across a couple of weeks to keep it contained, and also allowing it's natural for there to be more memories and reactions stirred up between sessions and for a little while. But just by keeping very close tabs on the people that we use exposure therapy with, whatever method we use, we have data on well over 100 people in this practice, have presented at many, many conferences, can be very confident to say the vast majority of people, on average, their intrusive thoughts and like avoidance symptoms go from a moderate level to just within the normal range overall as a common reaction, or around the border between the non-clinical and the mild range. And also anxiety and depression tend to come down to that kind of level as well. So basically, there's something predictable about this kind of approach. When the person's ready for it, it's been well explained, there's good collaboration there, the person has breathing techniques they can back themselves up with, maybe other strategies as well to manage their arousal. It helps if their partners know they're going through a challenging situation at that time, and the discomfort can usually be contained to a relatively brief period of time, so long as it's not been very long-standing horrendous abuse where people have all sorts of extra complications. If it's particularly trauma memories about one particular event, then could be more confident with that. If people have had very many traumatic events extended through their childhood and prominent dissociative symptoms as well, then the therapy can be more complicated and involved. You need to look at personality factors, also around mistrust that can come up. If people have experienced prominent abandonment in the past, there can be complications that people have, that we also look at things like schema therapy when people have other complications to do with, say, past repeated trauma in childhood. But for one-off events, and especially one-off events in adult life or even discrete events that children have faced, then these methods generally make a very significant difference in the vast majority of cases.
Well, I think that's a bit of a hopeful way to finish in some ways, Dad, because, you know, what we're talking about with this episode, it really is in some ways some of the darker aspects of life, like people who've gone through really horrible situations that you wouldn't wish on absolutely anyone. Like, we're talking about things like war and severe injury, things like this, like, just would absolutely not want anyone to go through it. But it is just a sad fact of life sometimes that some people, through no fault of their own, find themselves in these situations. But what I find really helpful about this, and I know that you mentioned it briefly there, like, we do have some practice data which suggests that in the majority of cases, people do certainly get to a level where it's not so much of a disruption in their life. They're, you know, ostensibly, you know, fully functioning, for lack of a better term. It's, they're not experiencing prolonged difficulties related to that traumatic event. And that's in the context of talking about some of just the most awful things that a person could go through in many ways. And even if someone is in one of those situations where it would just be so understandable to feel helpless, to have, you know, the bottom fall out of your world, even in those situations with exposure and even EMDR, we'll talk a little bit more about in the next episode. Strikes me that might even be maybe another level again on how to approach some of this stuff. But I do find it hopeful in some ways that even though we are talking about some of the darkest elements of life and some of the worst experiences that people could go through, there is something that we can do to ensure that most of the time that's not going to lead to prolonged issues into the future.
Yes, and so, look, just one thing so I don't gloss over this aspect as well. There can be complications if people have had some ongoing severe injury and pain. Chronic pain can be an extra complication. Certainly, prominent dissociation can be an extra complication. And we do have a podcast episode with Mark Grant on dealing with pain that could be helpful with that. We've got other podcast episodes on dissociation. But what we will do is we'll also post a couple of the clinical handouts that have used, well, basically for decades, used these same handouts with war veterans all those years ago and all the clients that I've seen in this practice that we deal with trauma reactions. One is called Exposure-Based Treatment for PTSD that describes these principles and the nature of trauma memories. Another one is called Dealing with Anxiety and PTSD. And so we'll put those resources on the website, and basically that will be, again, a reminder of the different principles that we've talked about in this podcast. And so generally, in addition to those handouts, it'll be good now to be able to have this podcast that people can listen to before they engage in any exposure-based therapy, because having an understanding of, well, why you're looking to go to that situation that normally you'd try not to think about, it becomes more the devil you know, and then it can defuse it. And so for many people, there's something which is quite uplifting and encouraging about that.
Well, absolutely. And we will put all those resources, including, for example, a couple of extra podcast episodes that we've done in the past, which are going to relate to people. If you've felt that today's episode has resonated at all, we've got some more podcast episodes on trauma and trauma reactions as well. And of course, next podcast episode that we do on EMDR as well will be up on the episode page, which you can access at psychspiels.com.au. And if you are listening on the internet, feel free to give us a subscribe or a follow on Apple or Spotify or wherever else you get your podcasts. But Dad, thanks for chatting with me about all this today. I'm just looking down and seeing it's a bit of a longer one. It's a bit of a meatier episode, but I think it's an important one to do in many ways, particularly if someone is in the situation where they do require exposure therapy, or they've got maybe a close loved one that requires exposure therapy. It seems the sort of thing where, you know, on the surface it can be a bit scary, it's going to maybe be a little bit uncomfortable in some ways, but it just strikes me that there is so much benefit to going through this process and maybe helping us get a little bit unstuck if we are experiencing a trauma memory.
Yes, well, certainly I've found over decades working as a therapist, understanding about trauma memories and having a way of defusing them, well, that's a cornerstone of a lot of our important work with many clients who've experienced significant trauma. And I'm glad that in the next episode we can talk about EMDR, which to me is a very satisfying therapy approach to be able to use, because you see how much benefit many people get from that.